From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Kojo Namdi Show. I'm Corey Flintoff, sitting in for Kojo. Coming up later in this hour, why the days of unlimited internet may soon be coming to an end. Tech Tuesday finds out why we all may soon be paying per gigabyte to shop on Amazon, download music, or send email. But first, speaking of email, offers of Viagra or low-interest loans or dirty pictures. Spam is familiar to anyone who uses a computer. And except for a few direct marketers, it's hard to find anyone who sings spam's praises. 4 years ago, when Jeremy Janes was arrested, a lot of people celebrated. Janes was the first person ever convicted of sending illegal spam email in the United States, sentenced to 9 years in prison for sending millions of unsolicited emails each day. But today he's out, scot-free. Why? Because the law he was convicted under, Virginia's anti-spam law, was invalidated this week by Virginia's own Supreme Court. To find out what was wrong with the law, we turn to Robert O'Neill. He's the director of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression and a professor of law at the University of Virginia Law School. Welcome, Bob.
Delighted to be with you.
Let's start out with the basics. I know you're not particularly a spam expert, but can you tell us what the Virginia law actually prohibited?
Sure. At least as the Virginia Supreme Court construed it, and a state Supreme Court does have final authority on what its own laws mean, it did two things that were problematic. One was to prohibit any false routing information as a way of accessing a server, which in this case happened to be the AOL server, located in Virginia.
Well, to clarify there, by false routing information, you mean a false name, for
yes,
instance.
And the reason that that's significant is because the court then went on to say, if somebody wants to send an anonymous message without revealing his or her identity, the only way you can do it is by having some false or inaccurate information in your sign-on. Put that aside for just a moment, and the problem is compounded by the fact that unlike the anti-spam laws passed by Congress or any of the other states, the Virginia law was not restricted in terms to commercial messages. That's what we think of as spam, unsolicited bulk commercial email, but could, as the Virginia Supreme Court read it, could also have been applied to anonymous political, religious, or other expressive speech. That's a quote right out of the opinion. Thus, they went on to say, if the authors of the Federalist Papers had tried electronically to circulate those documents today, they would effectively have been prevented from doing so, or they could have been charged under this statute because they were speaking anonymously. So it's those two factors interacting that caused the Virginia Supreme Court not simply to strike the law down, but to do so unanimously, which is unusual for most courts, but particularly unusual for this court.
And I understand from what you're saying that it sounds like you think the Supreme Court ruling in this case was correct.
Well, I think given the fact that the Virginia statute was so imprecise, did not target, as all the others do, strictly commercial messages, it left open that possibility of reaching non-commercial, political, religious, and so on material. Now, we have to bear in mind that Mr. Janes was engaged only in spamming. He's one of the world's great spammers, apparently. And he is also, he will not be scot-free. He is, in fact, already serving a federal 42-month sentence in a federal prison on a securities fraud charge. So, Mr. Janes will not soon be free to spam again. Thus, as his lawyer said, this is not necessarily a victory for Mr. Janes. It's a victory for free speech and the First Amendment.
Now, I'd like to urge callers to join us since everybody is affected by spam. You can join us by calling 1-800-433-8850, or you can email questions and comments to us at kojo@wamu.org. Just to, if in fact Mr. Janes is still in prison, is this essentially moot? I mean, are we still protected from spam by the federal laws, or
well,
is there something the states can do?
Certainly the federal can spam law, and I'm sure what the Virginia General Assembly will soon do is to pass a new law which is confined to commercial unsolicited bulk email, that is pure spam. And there's no suggestion that if states are specific in targeting what they're troubled by, what we're all troubled by, they can do that. Incidentally, there's another difference. Most of these state laws are essentially disclosure laws. They say if you send spam, you have to do two things. One, you have to identify the source in some way, sometimes by putting an ADV on the header or something like that.
And what's an ADV?
Spam. And the other is...
I'm sorry, just to clarify, what's an ADV?
Oh, advertisement. It's just short
I
for
see.
Advertisement. You can do it in other ways. And the other thing is you have to include a link that will enable a subscriber or recipient to unsubscribe. Now, we all know that's probably not a smart thing to do because once you go to unsubscribe, then essentially they've got you. So I think most of us rely on spam detectors and screens, which are increasingly sophisticated anyway.
Let's talk about this court case and how it came about. I mean, didn't the same court say around 6 months ago that this spam law was legitimate?
They did, and then for reasons that are not entirely clear, at the end or the middle of May, They did two things. They granted a rehearing, and then they issued another order, which actually invited the parties to address First Amendment issues in a way they hadn't been able to on the first round. So, yes, this is an extraordinary step of a court taking a second look. My hunch is that one of the reasons the court was troubled is that sending even an out-and-out flagrant spammer to jail for 9 years, that's an awfully severe penalty. But it's not for a court to say, well, that's more time than somebody ought to spend in jail. That's left to a jury and sometimes a judge in the sentencing process. The state Supreme Court seldom intervenes in that way, but I think there was growing concern about the fact that this is a felony, that Virginia's penalties, as well as its coverage, was substantially broader than that of any other state.
Do you think that if the state reinstates or comes up with a new law that fits the constitutional guidelines, that it's apt to restrict the severity of these sentences or the length of these sentences?
I'm not even sure that in reenacting the law, the Virginia General Assembly would necessarily look at the penalty provisions, because they're usually quite separate in the process. But I do think there's been enough concern about the severity of Mr. Jane's sentence that somehow that might get looked at in the process. But that clearly is a separate issue.
Does this law treat junk email the same way we treat junk snail mail, what piles up under the mailbox?
Fascinating question. And my starting point, I've taught for a dozen years a course entitled Free Expression in Cyberspace. And my starting point always is that speech or expression in electronic or digital form shouldn't be regulated any more extensively than the same message or material in print, unless there are special circumstances, and sometimes there are. We do require a sign-on to access even a public server at a state university, for example, which we don't require if somebody just wants to put something on a bulletin board or a kiosk as a physical flyer. But unless there's some special feature, something that's distinctive to cyberspace, then the rule seems to be, and the Supreme Court has said essentially this when they passed on the Communications Decency Act, the indecency provisions, and struck them down now over 11 years ago, this is a medium of expression that's entitled to full First Amendment protection. That being the case, we know that government can regulate commercial messages advertising in print forms, and certainly ought to be able to regulate electronic or digital commercial messages to the same degree, but not necessarily more broadly.
You know, one thing that strikes me that is different is that email is essentially cost-free to the spammer, whereas commercial advertising in snail mail is actually quite costly, even though advertisers get a break for bulk mail. Is that anything to base differences in the laws on?
I don't think so. I think it would be more the impact on the recipient. It used to be argued when bandwidth was limited that a whole lot of spam would clog a system, might even mess up the server, the Internet service provider. That's no longer really an issue. And it was also claimed that, say, employees would need to take additional time to delete spam from their inbox. But basically, that's not much different from having to take time to throw flyers and leaflets in print form out of their physical mailboxes. So those arguments have been raised, but they really don't rise to the level of a constitutional distinction.
We're talking with Bob O'Neill. He's the director of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression, and he's a professor of law at the University of Virginia Law School. Let's bring a caller in on this. This is Ryan from McLean, Virginia. Welcome, Ryan. You're on the air. Ryan, are you with us? You're on the air.
Not.
Okay, we'll go instead to John in Waldorf, Maryland. John, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a question for your guest, and that's that I don't understand why he's drawing the distinction between commercial email and religious or political email. In my view of the matter is that all of these are an unwanted intrusion upon my personal resources, and I think the analogy with junk paper mail is valid to a point, but the degree, you know, I get perhaps a half dozen pieces of junk email, junk mail a day, whereas I get literally several thousand chunks of spam a day, and you know that the analogy there, it breaks down on that level. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm just as annoyed by someone trying to push a religious point or a political point as I am by having someone try to sell me something in an unsolicited email. And I don't see the validity of saying, well, that's not a commercial transaction, so it's okay for them to do that.
Bob, what about protections for someone like John?
And it goes way back in terms of how the Supreme Court looks at free speech under the First Amendment. It wasn't until a little over 30 years ago that the Supreme Court gave any protection whatsoever to advertising or commercial speech, even though for a century and a half the court had given substantial protection to political, religious, and literary and other forms of speech and press. Even with this limited protection that's now, as I say, about 33 years old, advertising or commercial speech is still substantially less protected, starting out in print form, but the same has to be true in digital or electronic form, whereas political, religious, literary, and other forms of non-commercial speech we view as entitled to full First Amendment protection. Whether we like them or not, we can throw them out, we can refuse to take a phone call, we can certainly bar people from coming to our door and so on, but just in terms of receiving messages of that type, constitutional history and law say that we need to give a much higher level of protection to political and religious messages.
Thank you. Our guest has been Robert O'Neill, the director of the Thomas Jefferson Center for the Protection of Free Expression and a professor of law at the University of Virginia Law School. Thanks very much, Bob.
Thank you, Corey.
Now, we are going to take a short break here, and we'll come back and continue our conversation, in this case talking about why the days of unlimited Internet may soon be coming to an end. Stay tuned.
Next time on Tell Me More, Washington, D.C. School Chancellor Michelle Rhee wants to go beyond pizza and stickers for good grades to giving kids cold, hard cash.
The message that it sends to students is if you work hard and you do the right thing, and if you achieve at high levels, then you'll be rewarded for that.
But some say paying kids sends exactly the wrong message. I'm Michelle Martin. Our Mocha Moms weigh in. That's next time on Tell Me More.
Today at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. With thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away. From Trader Joe's, a grocery store offering shoppers back-to-school items like apple grape juice boxes made from 100% juice. New items arrive weekly. More information, including locations, at TraderJoe's.com. WAMU 88.5 is proud to be the media sponsor for Walking Town DC. Going on Saturday and Sunday, there will be more than 80 guided walking tours in neighborhoods across Washington. Professional guides and community leaders will show the way, telling historical tales, pointing out architectural gems, and discussing current issues. More information is at WAMU.org under calendar.
At 23 minutes after 12 noon, let's return to the Kojo Namdi Show.
Welcome back. I'm Corey Flintoff of National Public Radio, sitting in for Kojo Namdi, and calling all bandwidth hogs. The days of all-you-can-eat internet access may soon be over. The companies you buy broadband from are experimenting with pricing plans that cap your monthly consumption. It's a plan to reduce network traffic by targeting users who gorge themselves on extra-fat downloads. But with more television shows and movies becoming available online, today's bandwidth hog may soon be tomorrow's average user. And consumer advocates are worried that higher prices on the menu aren't the only things that are coming. Our guests are Ben Scott. He's the policy director at Free Press, a nonpartisan organization that advocates media reform and universal access to communications. And Scott Walston is the vice president for research and a senior fellow at the Technology Policy Institute and a senior fellow at the Georgetown Center for Business and Public Policy. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
And welcome to our callers. You can join us by calling 1-800-433-8850 or email us at kojo@wamu.org. Well, gentlemen, a lot of Americans use the internet like it's an all-you-can-eat buffet. I mean, you know, you pay your monthly fee, you download until you're full. But Comcast wants to cap the amount of bandwidth that people can consume per month. So start with you, Ben. What does this mean for the average customer?
Well, for right now, for most people, it doesn't mean a whole lot because the cap that they've set is relatively high. The concern that we have is looking ahead at the way that people use the internet. It's only logical to assume that people are going to use more and more bandwidth just as they have for the last 10 years, especially as more and more people begin to watch television online and high-definition television in particular. So if you imagine yourself in 5 years or in 2 years or maybe even in 1 year and you're a family of four or five and you're all on your laptops watching your favorite show or downloading last night's football game, pretty soon you're going to be running over that cap. And that's when the tax on the average consumer is going to hit them in the wallet, where Comcast is going to say, sorry, you went over the limit and now you owe us $300.
But the limit they're proposing is 250 gigabytes. I mean, for those of us who pretty much just email and Google things, you know, that seems like a colossal amount.
For today, it is. But think back to the days of dial-up internet. There are times when people said, wow, I've got a 56K modem. I'm scorching across the internet. I will never need more bandwidth than this. This is fantastic. I can, you know, surf the web without any delay. Our expectations change over time, and the pace of technology is such that it really is true that in a short period of time, large bandwidth consumption will be a common experience for most internet-using households.
Scott, is this something that we need to be worried about?
Well, as Ben said, for now, very few people are ever going to exceed the 250 gigabyte cap that Comcast has put on. And obviously, that's going to have to change in the future as we as more people are doing more things online. I mean, right now, a standard definition movie is about 2 gigabytes, and a high definition movie is around 4 gigabytes. It's really hard for someone to exceed those caps. Other companies are putting on lower caps. I believe Frontier put on a 5 gigabyte cap, which people are likely to exceed faster. But the point then is, how much are people going to pay total? Because then it's not just the price you're paying for access. You could pay a price for access, and then an additional price per per bit. And then the real question is, what is that first access price? And then what is that price per additional bit? Right now, I think nobody really knows what the right pricing mechanism is. Not Comcast, not Time Warner. I don't. And there's going to be a lot of experimenting going on, I think.
Well, what if we compare this, say, though, I mean, there is a congestion issue or a potential congestion issue. And, you know, I mean, if you compare it to the cities that are trying to reduce traffic by using congestion pricing, the idea being to free up lanes, you know, by charging drivers to be on the road during peak hours. Is this an idea that can apply to the information superhighway, and is it a good idea? Let me start with you, Scott.
Well, it's actually an idea in telecommunications that has been around for as long as there has been telecommunications. We used to pay higher prices during peak hours to make telephone calls for that very reason. And as voice traffic has become such a small component of all data traffic, and voice transmissions are very low bandwidth intensive, it's become more and more common to have all-you-can-eat pricing on voice calls. So this isn't a new concept in telecommunications. In fact, it's not even new in broadband. Many other countries around the world, many other OECD countries have imposed bit caps. I shouldn't say countries. Many providers in other countries have imposed bit caps for some time. But as an economist, of course, I think congestion pricing is great. And, you know, when there is congestion, an efficient way to deal with it is prices.
What do you think, Ben?
Well, I think that in the case of our infrastructure that the internet uses to deliver increasingly virtually every form of communication and business that we do in today's society, we have to ask ourselves where the balance point is between creating a system that is perfectly economically efficient and a system that is maximally beneficial to the public. And I think increasingly I think about internet access as a public good. This is something that we want to make sure everybody has access to. And we don't want to create a system of information inequality where this rich neighborhood has access to that technology at a much greater advantage than this poorer neighborhood or this rural area versus this urban area. The ideal public good is that this service is equally available to everyone on the same terms so that we all have the same advantages from being connected to it. So while I don't think that congestion pricing is a necessary evil, I think we have to consider, you know, what is the right model going forward and working with our infrastructure providers to make sure that we don't create a system that makes the information society pay for play.
See, the problem I have with that is that it can inadvertently end up hurting lower income people. If you want to say that everybody must have the very fastest, best infrastructure available, that's going to be more costly. And if it's more costly, somebody's going to have to pay for it, and then you're going to have essentially higher prices. There are people who will have lower uses, who lower demand, who would prefer to pay less, who won't need those higher services. And like I said, we don't really know what the right pricing mechanism is yet, and I wouldn't want to presume that I know it and to know what is the most socially beneficial system.
Seems to me that where the traffic analogy falls down is that it's a lot easier to add a lane to the internet than it is to a roadway. Is there infrastructure? Are there infrastructure improvements that could help traffic move on the internet where all this would be moot?
Well, sure. There are. You can improve the infrastructure, and companies are doing that. They're investing tens of billions of dollars. But to say that it's easier to add a lane to the internet than it is to add a lane to a highway, I'm not sure. I'm not sure exactly how to make that comparison because it's very expensive to upgrade infrastructure. I mean, look how much Verizon is paying to roll out Fios, $20-odd billion. And cable will be rolling out their upgraded so-called DOCSIS 3 system, which is also costly. But all of these things are costly investments, and that money's got to come from somewhere.
I do think it's wise for us to remember our recent past, lest we are condemned to repeat it. These tales of the internet becoming overcrowded and crashing and not being available for anyone because the congestion is so bad and the need to establish caps and congestion pricing, industry rolls out these scary stories about every couple of years, and they float a trial balloon and they have a test market and they see whether consumers will tolerate these sorts of pricing plans and they see whether it works. And every time up to now, they've put the brakes on it and they've rolled it back because there's a great deal of consumer demand for this open platform that everybody can get online and have the expectation that no matter where they are, no matter which service provider they're connected to, they can assume the same internet experience. And I think that is the key to understanding why the internet is so popular and why it's become such an important part of our life, is because it's the user experience, our experience with the network is always the same. It's a remarkable thing, unlike any other media that's preceded it.
But it seems to me that didn't people have a lot more freedom when the internet was less of a necessity? But it's becoming more and more of an. You know, I could choose when and whether to use the internet, but increasingly I no longer can. I mean, I need it for phone service now and things like that. Aren't we more and more at the mercy of internet providers?
It's become an absolute necessity. A really interesting paper that was written by some professors, one in California and one in Pennsylvania, studying what it means to be on the wrong side of the digital divide. And what they're looking at is, as internet access becomes more and more prevalent in the United States and there are fewer and fewer people who aren't connected, what are the costs of being not connected? And what they found in their analysis is that the longer you don't have access to the internet, the worse it hurts you in terms of economic opportunity and social opportunity. So the notion that we can slowly and incrementally push internet access out into communities that are the least among us, that idea breaks down because we're actually hurting those communities worse by leaving them until last. So we have to always factor these things in if we're thinking about internet access as this sort of social and economic necessity.
So Ben makes that's an excellent point. But it's not clear that saying that firms, providers must use all-you-can-eat pricing is the way to do that. Historically, public interest groups tried to ensure that low-income groups would have access to some basic level of telecommunications that was usually some very low-cost basic level of communications. Now suddenly they've switched and seem to be demanding that everybody have access to the very highest quality, most expensive broadband. Now, ensuring that everyone is connected doesn't mean that everybody has 100 megabit per second internet. And to make sure that everyone is connected in useful ways may require different types of pricing. There's an interesting paper, we're talking about papers, on actually congestion pricing by Cliff Winston, who is an economist at the Brookings Institution, who looks at the efficiency of congestion pricing versus building infrastructure and roads, and shows that our investment in road infrastructure has been hugely inefficient and wasteful relative to what we could have gained simply by using congestion pricing. And there is an analogy. It's not perfect, of course, but it's a useful analogy.
We're talking about potential caps on internet use. I'm talking with Ben Scott. He's the policy director at Free Press, a nonpartisan organization that advocates media reform and universal access to communications. And Scott Walston, he's the vice president for research and a senior fellow at the Technology Policy Institute. You can join us and should, because this is all going to impact all of us sooner or later, calling at 1-800-433-8850, or you can email comments to us at kojo@wamu.org. Now, I'd like to bring in Garrett from Rockville, who may be able to address this specific issue of reaching everybody. Garrett, welcome. You're on the air.
Hey, thanks, Corey. I just moved to D.C. about a month ago, and I'm a computer networking person who's looking for a job right now. And I love telecommunication policy, so I just love that this conversation came out. Anyway, if you look at what the telecommunications industry has been doing for businesses for a long time, they're offering, like, frame relays with a fixed line speed that is like T3, would be 44 megabits a second. And then in that package, they offer a committed information rate, say, 4 megabits per second. So at any given time, that business can send 4 megabits out. But if no one happens to be using the network, you could be going up to that 44 megabit ultimate speed. This gets really important, I guess, when you're talking about home users in the future, when we have voice over IP, which might be carrying 911 calls. You want to be able to get a dial tone so you can actually make these connections to the world. So a 250 gig gap or just packet's not going to help you out, because network utilization is cyclical. I mean, it depends on the time of day, the day of the week, and all that. So I was just wondering what you guys think about having something with a committed rate of something and letting us burst as fast as we can with our equipment the rest of the time if the network can support it.
You want to start that off, Scott?
Sure. I think that's an excellent point. And one is that to point out that businesses do purchase the types of connections and speeds that they need configured in different ways. And Garrett's right that to deal with congestion pricing, to deal with potential congestion, you do want to target the times, the areas that are specifically congested, and that's the way telephone pricing used to be. It was higher during peak hours. That's the way the metro is in D.C. You pay more to travel during rush hour. And a 250 gigabit cap doesn't deal with time congestion based on time at all. In this case, Comcast seems to be targeting that's a very small share of people who are abusing the system, essentially trying to run servers off their home connection. But to truly deal with congestion, yeah, it'll have to be more focused at the times and places that there is congestion.
I want to tease out another point that the caller raises, which is really essential for any consumer to understand about the $50 a month that they're shelling out for internet access. And that's something that I think very few consumers know, which is that if you're a cable modem subscriber like I am, the cable company in Washington is usually Comcast. They cannot guarantee you a speed. The minimum speed that the caller is referring to, that we all ought to know, like at the very least I'm getting this for my money, there is no such guarantee. You can read the 8-point font in your Terms of Service booklet. You will not find that number in there, I guarantee you, because they can't guarantee a minimum speed because of the way the network is architected. So it really points to this fundamental question of what is it that we want as a society? What do we want as a foundation of our information economy? Do we want a network that can promise X level of speed to everyone? And what does that mean, and how do we get it? And I think that those are fundamental questions as we move forward for economic policy.
If you look at internationally, though, I mean, the United States has fallen way behind just with how things have been constructed historically. And it's a very important point to just look at where we are in that regard also. And when we're talking about bringing in lower-end people, talking about the universal services that we've had in telecommunications forever also.
You're absolutely right. Over the last several years, the United States has fallen behind the world leaders in broadband internet access. That's a huge problem for us, not only for those who are left behind here at home, but also for our global competitiveness. Every rank that we drop next to the world leaders in Europe and Asia are jobs and economic growth that we're not having here at home. That's a big problem that we really have to address. And I think it's going to be core for the next administration.
This is actually something I've written about, and Ben and I have debated this. It's not really the focus of the show, but I think those statistics are actually flawed. And when you look at household penetration, we're actually more like between 7th and 9th among OECD countries. The problem is with how connections are counted, that they miss business connections, and it has to do with household size and so on. There's a question of how you encourage investment in the network, and Europe right now has a big problem that there's almost no fiber deployment except in a few countries because they can't figure out how to induce providers to roll out fiber since they have to share it with their competitors. And this is an issue with which we disagree and have debated, and probably is a different topic.
Well, we'll come back to that. We're talking about right now about the prospect that the days of all-you-can-eat internet may soon be over, and we're talking with Ben Scott and Scott Walston. We'll continue our conversation after a short break, so please stay tuned. Coming up at 1, French philosopher and journalist Bernard-Henri Lévy on the love-hate relationship between his country and the U.S. and whether anti-Americanism is bad for France. Today at 1 on the Kojo Namdi Show on WAMU 88.5.
Next time on Tell Me More, Washington, D.C.'s school chancellor Michelle Rhee wants to go beyond pizza and stickers for good grades to giving kids cold, hard cash.
The message that it sends to students is if you work hard and you do the right thing, and if you achieve at high levels, then you'll be rewarded for that.
But some say paying kids sends exactly the wrong message. I'm Michelle Martin. Our Mocha Moms weigh in. That's next time on Tell Me More.
Today at 2 on WAMU 88.5.
Support for WAMU 88.5 comes from CDWG. With thousands of technology products in stock, they're there to get public sector customers what they need when they need it on purchasing vehicles specific to their organizations. CDWG, the right technology right away. From the University of Pennsylvania, EMTM, Penn's Executive Masters in Technology Management Program, hosts an information session in Tyson's Corner on Thursday, September 25th. More information at emtm.upenn.edu.
72 degrees and cloudy skies in northwest Washington. We'll reach the mid-70s by the end of the afternoon. Let's return to the Kojo Namdi Show.
Welcome back. I'm Corey Flintoff of National Public Radio, sitting in for Kojo Namdi. We're talking with Ben Scott and Scott Walston about the prospect that of putting caps on Internet use. And we've actually attracted a lot of email questions from listeners. This is from Aaron, and he asks, how much of the bandwidth cap is really due to congestion as opposed to cable companies that see Internet TV as a threat and have seen resistance when they try application-specific bandwidth management? I'm not sure I follow that. You may have to explain this to me, but how much is really all about cable companies wanting to resist Internet TV?
I think that's really an excellent question, because that potentially is a real issue. You want to make sure that the Internet providers aren't trying to benefit their own services at the expense of competing services by degrading their services or making it impossible for other companies to provide those services. But that's inherently an antitrust issue. That is already illegal. And when that happens, it's the role of the Justice Department to step in and try to prosecute that. It doesn't seem that they've been targeting those companies. I mean, there've been no blocks on YouTube or Apple TV or Amazon, Amazon Unbox and so on. But I think that sort of antitrust issue is something to keep an eye out for, and the Justice Department should be vigilant.
I think that it is a hugely important concern, both for right now as we anticipate where the future of the Internet is going, and certainly down the road. You can easily imagine, let's take a company like Time Warner that both owns a lot of content and it has a cable network, and they're thinking to themselves, you know, what happens when people start going to their computers and they're watching YouTube and online video instead of watching my cable TV? Well, at some point, they may just decide to quit paying for my cable TV. Well, that makes me really nervous if most of my money comes from my cable TV product and not from my Internet service. So, yeah, absolutely. If there's a conscious effort to discriminate against the online video, that's a real problem. But you can also see more subtle forms of this, which would be troubling to me, such as, let's say there's a cap, and if you go over the cap, you have to pay extra. But if you watch the video products that they own, then it doesn't count against the cap. But if you watch somebody else's video product, then it does count against the cap. Or what if you're watching some competitive video product and it just doesn't work as well, and it's really difficult to figure out why it doesn't work as well as an end user, but you're pretty but when you go and you look at the video that's owned by the cable company, well, by God, that works really well. That's the kind of self-dealing and discrimination that we're very concerned about.
I think it's important to point out, I mean, first of all, that kind of self-dealing is generally illegal. I mean, this is a classic antitrust issue, and Ben mentions the potential problem of counting other companies' downloads against your cap and not your own. I don't think that's actually the case at the moment. But another important point is that this market is more complicated than that implies. This is really what economists call a two-sided market, where the broadband is the provider is a platform that needs to get end users and it needs to have content. Without one, it can't have the other. And if they were to start degrading content, it will reduce demand for the broadband service. And it's not clear who has market power in this case. If they started, if a company started degrading Google services, Google could retaliate. They're more likely to be more powerful than others. And in fact, we do see already content providers that require the broadband providers to pay to allow their consumers to access their services, this sort of reverse net neutrality. And to understand how the market will play out, you have to think about it in terms of this multi-sided market, which makes it really complicated to understand and to figure out where things will settle down and how different things should be priced.
Let's look at a specific example of at least this kind of application-specific broadband management. Back in August, the FCC said Comcast was blocking traffic on its network to a certain file-sharing site. The company, which has sued the FCC in protest, said it sometimes slows traffic to certain sites to prevent heavy users from affecting the quality of service it can provide to everyone else. So what do you take away from that story?
Well, the story has really come to a decision, and the regulator that oversees the cable networks made a determination that, in fact, Comcast was blocking consumers' access to the Internet and to the sites of their choice, and that was illegal. They have told Comcast they have to stop doing that and that sort of behavior won't be tolerated. But it really points to this underlying question of when does the user know how and whether their cable companies are discriminating against their favorite websites. It took years for this particular case that you mentioned to come to light and for it to be prosecuted. It was really a bellwether, a test case. And I think that anybody who's listening to the show, who's a cable television customer or a cable modem subscriber, doesn't really have any illusions about who's in control of the relationship between the consumer and the cable company. And I often get the feeling that I'm going to get a call from the cable operator informing me that the truth about what's happening on my network will be delivered next Thursday between 8 and 6.
Well, that's probably true if you're essentially using BitTorrent to upload lots and lots of files, but I'm not sure it affected other consumers.
Nonetheless, this case is very important in terms of what it means for the future of the Internet and the fact that the government stepped in and said, yeah, there's going to be a cop on the beat for consumers, and not every consumer is going to have to take on that cable company one-on-one and get dumped into call center vortexes. There's going to be somebody there who says, no, you can't operate your network like that. You can't discriminate against people. You can't punish your customers for problems in your network. And we're going to bring these things to the light of day, and we're going to ask you to disclose to your customers exactly what kind of service that you're selling, and that's, I think, a positive direction.
The disclosure issue is a big one. I mean, they can't do something and then claim they're not doing it. Consumers need to know what they're buying. That's absolutely true. But it's not clear that what they were doing should be wrong. And the way the FCC made this decision, was really not good. And anybody who cares about an independent regulator, which the FCC is, should be troubled by the way that the decision happened. The decision was made in secret. The order was not released until 2 weeks after it was voted on. Now, an independent regulator, I've worked on regulatory issues around the world, should be not just independent, but it has to operate transparently, and it has to be held accountable. This decision was anything but transparent. And the groups that are happy with the decision should be very worried that the next decision made this way may be one that they don't like, and they won't know why.
Ben, you liked the decision, but did you like the way it was made?
Well, the process that Scott's describing is common to virtually every decision that this agency makes. It is certainly less transparent on the whole than we would like. We're always after more transparency in federal rulemakings. I don't think that this particular decision was unusual in the way it was conducted. I will say that the commission went out of its way to make sure that they understood exactly what Comcast was doing and what the rights of the consumer should be. There were field hearings held, one at Harvard and MIT, another out in Stanford. Professors of engineering and law came out. thousands of consumers who had experienced the problem with Comcast commented in the docket at the federal agency, which is totally unprecedented in such an arcane decision-making process. I think that, you know, this thing was played out in the press for months and months and months. I don't know how you get more scrutiny on an issue than was played on this particular case.
Well, one way to get more scrutiny would be to release the order before it's voted on. I mean, the other commissioners complained about not having seen the order, that it was being rewritten the night before, and then it wasn't released to the public. I mean, the FCC is supposed to have a very clear rulemaking process, and transparency and process is hugely important in an independent agency that's not, you know, directly accountable to the political process. And I think, you know, once you go down the road of this lack of transparency, it's a big problem. I mean, we advocate to other countries around the world to build regulators that are independent, transparent, accountable, and have the capacity to do their jobs. And for our regulator to act in such a way, I think doesn't instill a lot of confidence.
Let's stop it at that point, because I'd like to give listeners a more of a chance to come in here. Here's Mike from Severn, Maryland. Mike, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, Corey. Thanks for taking my call. I think it's a great topic. My question is, I know what my usage is on my cell phone because I get a statement, but the 250 gig limit actually means nothing to me. I have no idea how much I download. I telework a couple of days a week. You know, I take a University of Maryland class online, hit a few websites, iTunes, download a few tunes, download a few movies through Netflix, but that I really don't have any idea what that means. Would they be revealing what my capacity usage would be so I could have an idea of my usage?
I think it's an excellent point. Consumers absolutely need to know what their usage is if there are going to be caps. There must be a way for them to know.
Yeah, Mike, my advice to you if you're a Comcast subscriber is worry, because their track record is not exactly one of transparency and consumer-friendly relations. And you know, up to this point, you know, the reason why they have suddenly declared that it's going to be a 250 gigabyte cap and picked that number is because up to this point it's been a secret number. The number has always existed, and if you went over it, they sent you a letter and kicked you off the network or charged you double the bill. It was only because they were sued by the Florida Attorney General and lost the case that they were forced to actually identify a number and say, okay, from now on it's 250. I guess we'll grudgingly tell our customers exactly what it is that they're being sold for their $50 a month. And it's astounding, but that's just the nature of the power of this industry. There's not a lot you can do about it.
Well, it's certainly a level of trust issue with the companies we're dealing with, and I am, unfortunately, a Comcast subscriber, but I appreciate the information.
Thanks. Let's go to Rod in Columbia, Maryland. Rod, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you. My question is, if I'm a mobile broadband subscriber with Verizon Wireless, and is there a potential for cap with mobile broadband? And as far as transparency, how's Verizon Wireless broadband? Are they transparent with their service? And whether the upload and download speed, you know, what they deliver is what they promise on a contract? And I'll take my answer off the air.
I would have to look up the terms of service for Verizon Wireless to be specific, but my understanding is that almost every one of the wireless carriers has a cap already. The wireless networks are amongst the most constrained of any internet connection that you can buy. There are services that you're not allowed to use on the internet, even though you're buying quote-unquote unlimited internet access. That contradiction continues to be a sore point for me, and I think should be a thorn in the side of any consumer who's dropping $80 a month on unlimited internet access that is not unlimited and doesn't give you access to everything. I think these are questions that will be played out and given a heavy amount of attention in the aftermath of the Comcast decision that we saw in August, because now the federal regulators are sticking up for consumers for the first time in many years, and all these network operators are going to have to sit up and take notice.
This is true around the world, actually. Wireless providers are more likely to have bit caps than our wired providers, simply because there's less capacity.
I just go to one final question here, and that is a lot of consumers are used to, you know, we pay one company for the phone bill, we pay another for cable, we pay a third for the internet connection. But now, you know, you can get these triple play packages where you get all three services from one provider. How is this changing telecommunications as a marketplace for us?
Well, What it's doing is, in exchange for giving you a slight discount, you're more often than not locked into a long-term contract, which means that you're not likely to switch providers, even if you have a choice. And that means you basically have to take it on the chin if Comcast decides to do X, Y, or Z that you don't like, set a bit cap, start blocking you from going to one website or the other. Because you're locked into a contract, you don't want to go through the trouble of having the tech come out on Thursday between 8 and 6 and figure out how to swap out all the boxes. You know, consumers just don't want to do that. They don't want to put up with a headache. And really, the cable and phone companies are counting on you not wanting to have the headache and dealing with whatever consumer-unfriendly practices they might want to put upon you.
But to say that consumers are locked in, you're assuming then that consumers don't know what they're getting into when they sign up for a bundled package. And for lots of consumers, they consider that a good deal. And, you know, I don't think we have really any idea of the extent of losses, or whether welfare has been improved or hurt by this. We simply don't know. We do know that these bundles seem to do give people a discount. Some have contracts, some don't. Back 10 years ago, everyone was saying that people wanted, they called it one stop shopping. They could pay one bill instead of three. Some people still do. Others don't.
I'm not saying it's a bad deal. I'm just saying there's no such thing as a free lunch.
Well, that's certainly true.
Well, and the question is, once we've gotten used to it, is it reversible? I mean, is the marketplace allow for going back to buying your services from different providers?
I think that they're going to work against that. I think that they want you to buy the bundle. They want you to buy everything from them. They don't want you to mix and match. And so if you try to buy one of those three products separately, it's going to cost you a lot more. You're going to be penalized for that. That's part of the pricing decisions that they make. You know, in the absence of lots of competition in this market where you have six or eight different choices, that's inevitably going to happen. And to me, that's why we use the law to make sure that consumers are protected, that the basic principles of openness and access for the public at large for social and economic benefit are furthered. This is the balance that consumers have with these big companies, is they have the law on their side.
Bundling is that's another complicated antitrust issue. Sometimes it has large benefits to consumers, and it can be used also in anti-competitive ways. But bundling can bring lots of benefits, and I don't think we've analyzed these bundles properly.
We'll have to do that in another time. I'd like to thank my guest Ben Scott. He's the policy director at Free Press. That's a nonpartisan organization that advocates media reform. Scott Walson is a vice president for research and a senior fellow at the Technology Policy Institute. Thank you both very much for joining us. Coming up tomorrow on the Kojo Namdi Show, nuclear technology in Washington's backyard and beyond, as Maryland pushes to build a new reactor in Calvert County. We look at the nuts and bolts of going nuclear. Plus, a journalist digs deep into a story of drug addiction, his own. New York Times media critic David Carr on his struggles with substance abuse and how he put his life back together. The Kojo Namdi Show, noon till 2 tomorrow on WFMU.